Dorothy landing in Oz, going from black and white to Technicolor. It was immaculate. The walls and the floors, the furniture and the decor, everything was fresh, clean, and bright. Hanging on her living room wall were photographs of her 10 children, 9 girls and 1 boy, all of whom had been raised in the Robert Taylor homes and had gone on to college. Mrs. Jefferson exuded immense pride for all that she had done to protect and nurture her children so that they could thrive under the harshest of circumstances. Nearly everyone had moved out, but she did not want to leave. She'd moved in right at the beginning when Taylor was first opened in 1962. She repeated what we had also heard from Mayor Richard J. Daley at the opening ceremony. She said, "My family viewed the Taylor homes as a step up from where we were before. I raised my children here. It's my home." I too wanted Laura and Maude to meet Mrs. Jefferson, so they would better understand the stories I had shared with them about the people I'd met there and how the criminal stereotype skewed the image of the residents badly. I knew one visit alone could never fully capture the varied lives of the many people who'd made their homes in public housing, but I wanted the girls to see that the history of the community that lived there was in reality more complicated than the singularly violent depiction on the 10 o'clock news. The last of the Robert Taylor homes was demolished on March 8, 2007, but everyone who had lived there, with a lease in good standing, was guaranteed a new home. Chapter 7. My Best Hire Ever. The idea that black people need to work twice as hard and be twice as good has been repeated to us time and again. We've absorbed it in our bloodstream. It's become second nature. But for a phrase that's become so commonplace, we often leave out an important part. Yes, work twice as hard so that you can be twice as good, but also you need to be lucky too. Luck plays an enormous role in all of our lives. Working twice as hard earned my father his medical degree, but it was luck that he happened to know a man who happened to know about a job offer in Iran, which was the opportunity that began to allow him to flourish. If you're not working hard, you won't be in a position to take advantage of luck when it comes your way. But you still need the luck. And in the summer of 1991, during the brief four-month window while I was busy working twice as hard as Mayor Daley's deputy chief of staff, luck landed on my desk. Plowing through an ever-growing pile of incoming mail, I saw a handwritten note from Susan Schur, by then one of the city's top lawyers and one of my best friends, attached to a resume. It read, "Very impressive, bright, mature, interested in public service, does not want to practice law. Please meet with her." Quickly scanning the resume, it was obvious why Susan had sent it my way. A 26-year-old Chicago native, cum laude grad of Princeton, Harvard Law alum, and now second-year associate at the law firm of Sidley Austin. The name at the top was Michelle Robinson. I called Michelle in for an interview, and when she walked into my office, I was immediately struck not just by her appearance, tall, strikingly beautiful, simply dressed, with her hair pulled back and barely a hint of makeup, but also by her composed demeanor. She had a firm handshake, made direct eye contact, and exuded a confidence that I had rarely seen in anyone as young. All the other candidates I'd interviewed had tried to impress me by hard-selling their strengths. Michelle let her resume speak to her credentials and instead told me about her background, growing up in a working-class neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. Her father, a blue-collar worker with the city's water department, prided himself on working hard even as he endured multiple sclerosis. As she described his involvement as a precinct captain in ward politics and his love for this city, it was clear the loss of her father a few months earlier was still fresh and painful. We compared stories about shared experiences, such as the drudgery of law firm life, the gift of being raised by happily married parents, and being instilled with a sense of responsibility to give back. Michelle talked less to impress than to simply inform. We also talked about the loss of young people we loved. Her best friend from college had died too young from cancer. My younger cousin, Jackie Cook, had been killed in 1981 by a drunk driver during the summer after her freshman year in college. About 30 minutes in to what was supposed to be a 20-minute interview, she got down to business. Innocuous questions that any job candidate might ask, such as the responsibilities of the position, turned into a rigorous and thoughtful grilling. How many staff are you going to have? What will the organizational chart be? What kind of projects will be assigned to me, and who will make those assignments? What will happen if I disagree with a decision of Mayor Daley? Her questions made me uncomfortable, not because they weren't perfectly legitimate, but because no one had ever asked them before. I was so used to people selling themselves to me that I was both startled and impressed by the ease with which Michelle turned the tables. What an unusual young person, I thought, to be able to realize that it was as important for her to want to work for me as it was for me to want her to show the maturity I certainly didn't possess at her age. After well over an hour had passed, with meetings stacking up, I was running late, and I am never late. I straight up offered her the job, which I had no authority to do. I hadn't talked to David Messina, the chief of staff, or the mayor, but I was so impressed with Michelle that I blurted out an offer on the spot. I could tell she was perfect for the job. She exuded competence, as well as character and integrity. It was also clear that her moral compass pointed only in one direction, true north, and I really liked her. Wisely, Michelle said she needed to think about it. A few days later, I called Michelle to check in and see if she was ready to accept my offer, which by then I had cleared with my bosses. She got right to the point. She talked it over with her fiancé, and he had some serious reservations. What? Thinking she and I had really clicked, I wasn't expecting that wild card. All the other applicants were clamoring for a job in the mayor's office. Who the hell is your fiancé? I blurted out. And why do we care what he thinks? With a disarming laugh, she said, his name is Barack Obama, and he thinks the mayor's office could be a dangerous place to work. We're a team and make all big life decisions together. Barack Obama. I'd heard of him. I didn't know him personally, but there weren't many black lawyers in the country who hadn't heard of the first black president of the Harvard Law Review in its then 104-year history. He also had received some local attention as a successful community organizer on Chicago's South Side before he went to law school. Plus, his name is not one you forget. Michelle said that she and Barack, who had just graduated from law school, wanted to know if I'd be willing to have dinner with the two of them to discuss the job. It was an unconventional request, to say the least, but I really wanted to hire her. And if that's what I had to do to win her over, then dinner it was. What a wise decision on my part. Within the week, I was sitting in a booth across from the young couple at a popular restaurant not far from City Hall. From my phone conversation with Michelle, I knew that Barack had recently moved back to Chicago to practice as a civil rights lawyer, and he was weary that Mayor Daley might succumb to machine politics. I understood his reservations, since I, too, had questioned whether the mayor would remain committed to Harold Washington's progressive ideals. So I'd come armed with a slew of arguments to convince them that this was the right job for Michelle. But instead of launching into hardball questions about, say, the mayor's plan for the city's decaying neighborhoods or employment resources for the residents, Barack started by simply asking me, "Where are you from?" "Chicago," I answered. "Were you born here?" I took a deep breath, as I always did whenever I was asked this question. "No, I was born in Iran," I said. Typically, at this point in any conversation, I'd receive a look of surprise, followed by a series of banal questions that I'd quickly dispatch so the conversation could move on. But that did not happen here. Barack smiled and he leaned in. He genuinely wanted to know more. He asked thoughtful follow-up questions that proved he was really listening. and I found myself slowly opening up and telling him my story. I described how I arrived in the United States at age 5, red-headed, freckled kid who spoke Farsi, French, and English with an accent, dealt with bullying because I was different, and not surprisingly, just like any kid, wanted to fit in. And since I still felt uncomfortable talking about my exotic beginnings, even as an adult, I suppose I still wanted to fit in. But Barack's unexpectedly open and curious responses put me at ease. He told me about his own international background and his biracial parents, his African father, who'd abandoned him at the beginning of his life, and the several years of his youth spent in Indonesia with his white mother. He talked about his close relationship with his grandparents, a lot like mine with Puddin'. We discussed memories and ideas that I had previously confided only in my parents, how much we had both learned from living abroad, and how we had a different attitude toward the privileges so many Americans take for granted, from civil liberties to clean water. Or how, when we meet a person from another country or with a different background, we always expect to find something in common, language barriers or not. Appreciating the importance of being willing to search for common ground, and that we had both figured out early on that while the United States is the greatest country on earth, it's not the only one, and we could, and had, both learned much beyond our shores. As a child, I wanted only to blend in, but my conversation with Barack made me feel like I was no longer unique, for we shared such similar experiences. Although we had just met, we were already finishing each other's sentences while Michelle listened intently, amused at our bonding session. Finally, as we moved into the third hour of dinner, our discussion turned to City Hall. The young couple shared my passion for public service, but were unsure how best to serve. Keenly aware of the values of their education and life experiences, they wanted to maximize their abilities to make a positive difference. I delicately told Barack that although I had enormous respect for his work as a community organizer, there's a great value in fighting for the powerless from inside government, and that desire is what drove me to join city government. The paramount concern for both of them was being able to serve the public and stay true to their values. "I will protect you," I said to Michelle. "I'll never ask you to do anything you're uncomfortable doing, and I will stand in the way of anyone who does." I won both of them over, and in the summer of 1991, Michelle joined me in the mayor's office. And in the many years that followed, life has carried the three of us on an extraordinary journey. On the same day I resigned from the Department of Planning and Development to join the Habitat Company, Mayor Daley appointed me chair of the board of the Chicago Transit Authority. It was a public peace offering for the rocky way my departure was playing out in the press. The mayor assured me that chairing the CTA would be an easy lift. It was not. Public transit is, alongside housing, one of the biggest lightning rods for angry residents. And at my very first briefing, the president of the CTA informed me that he was exploring options for bankruptcy. A few years later, when we reached the point where demonstrators were showing up in front of my home to protest budget cuts, Laura, 13 at the time, was mortified. I tried to explain to her that I wanted to be the one who made the tough decisions, and that they weren't always popular. That's what leadership means. She was still skeptical and remained so for a long time. One time she stood next to me after a community meeting, watching helplessly as some outraged activist yelled at me inches from my face. Still, chairing the CTA board and working on neighborhood redevelopment at Habitat gave me a large platform in which to continue my public service while working in the private sector. Michelle, just as I knew she would, easily conquered the bureaucracy of City Hall and made magic happen. It was no easy feat, but she was relentless, refusing to ever take no for an answer. One day, as I strolled past a conference room, I heard her commanding voice through the door. "You're not leaving this room until it's solved." I smiled and kept walking, knowing that to whomever she was speaking didn't stand a chance. After a couple years in city government, she had left for an extraordinary opportunity to start up the Chicago Office of Public Allies, a nonprofit dedicated to young adult leadership under AmeriCorps. And Barack, though he hadn't yet run for office, had been busy putting the building blocks of his future career in place. Despite being the most sought-after young lawyer in the country after leaving Harvard Law School, he'd chosen Davis, Minor, Barnhill, and Gallon, a small Chicago law firm rooted in civil rights and community development law. He was also lecturing at the University of Chicago Law School and had, in July of 1995, just published his first memoir, Dreams from My Father. Starting with our very first dinner, the three of us gradually developed a very close friendship. After they married in 1992, they moved three blocks away from me, and we spent a lot of time at each other's homes. It was, admittedly, an unusual friendship. I was like a big sister to them as a couple, and also separately as individuals. Michelle and I bonded over our deep Chicago roots and raising children while balancing our career responsibilities, while Barack and I bonded over the exotic, far-flung adventures of our childhoods and his interest in politics. And all three of us shared a dedication to and a sense of responsibility for careers in public service. We nurtured a relationship and learned we could be completely honest with one another and could share our boldest ideas and confide our deepest fears. We could tell one another hard truths and trust that those truths were said with no agenda but love. My relationship with Barack and Michelle was one of the many overlapping connections in a small group that came into its own on the south side of Chicago during those years. It was a group of friends so close-knit, we felt like family. There was my childhood friend John Rogers, who counted my dad as one of the first investors and corporate directors in his business. John had gone to Princeton with Michelle's brother Craig. Kelly King Dibble, who had married my cousin Andrew, worked with Michelle and me at City Hall and had twins the same month Malia was born. There was Eric Whitaker, a former student of my dad's and later a colleague of Michelle's at the University of Chicago Medical Center, and Marty Nesbitt, Barack's best friend. His wife, Anita Blanchard, an OBGYN, was a former student of my dad's, a med school classmate of Eric's, and she delivered both Malia and Sasha Obama. Although we all came from different backgrounds, we were part of a generation of Black Americans who understood that every step toward success meant we were all breaking new ground. We all wanted to help each other live up to the high expectations we had set for ourselves. The election of Mayor Harold Washington had empowered Black Chicagoans, both individually and collectively. His success proved our voices mattered. As our group became closer, we all realized we felt firmly connected to that phenomenon. Even for those of us who didn't join government, there was still a level of engagement and interest in politics and service. In fact, politics was often the topic of conversation. And as we each found professional success, we also knew that we had a responsibility not just to vote and volunteer to knock on doors, but also to actively support candidates in whom we believed. From the very first time I met Barack, I suspected he might one day be one of those candidates. Not for president, mind you. Not in my wildest dreams did I imagine that. But I do remember thinking that it was entirely possible that he might one day even be mayor of Chicago. So when he dropped by my office to say he was thinking about running for state senate, I wasn't at all surprised. Alice Palmer, our state senator, had decided not to run for re-election, and since it's always easier to run for an open seat than to challenge an incumbent, Barack thought it would be a good way in, and I agreed. Since I had just started working at the Habitat Company and chairing the Chicago Transit Authority, I wasn't too involved in the campaign. All I remember is going to the first organizational meeting of his kitchen cabinet. I was only there as a friend and fundraiser. But to me, from the beginning, it seemed like his first campaign would be a slam dunk. And other than a little messiness when Alice waffled on running, it was. 4 years after being elected to the state senate, Barack decided to run for a different seat, this time challenging Bobby Rush, the popular incumbent who represented and still represents the first congressional district of Illinois in the U.S. House of Representatives. My involvement in that campaign, again, was strictly as a friend and supporter. But I thought, well, we all thought, that Barack had a good chance to win based on his sheer talent alone. We were wrong. The first mistake was that we underestimated the power of the incumbency. Bobby Rush was well known and had been in office since 1993. He was familiar. There were a number of people who had known the congressman from back in the day when he was a militant Black Panther activist, and they liked that he was a fighter. Barack, on the other hand, was a newcomer without deep roots in Chicago. There was also a generational divide and a class divide in the district as well. The first district encompasses two distinct communities, the lower-income, predominantly Black North Kenwood-Oakland area, and the neighborhood of Hyde Park, South Kenwood, the racially integrated home of the University of Chicago and the lakefront liberals who had backed Harold Washington. We thought Barack had the appeal to reach both of those constituencies, but in the end, he didn't. While Barack did well with the white progressives and the younger, upwardly mobile segment of the Black community, Bobby Rush proved far more popular with the older generation in North Kenwood and Oakland. It didn't help Barack's standing when, in 1999, he missed an important vote in the state Senate for an anti-crime bill. He and Michelle and their daughters, Malia and Sasha, were in Hawaii for his annual trip to visit his grandmother when Sasha, who was 18 months old at the time, came down with an earache. Unwilling to leave Michelle, who was also unwilling to be left, with a sick toddler and a four-year-old, he stayed in Hawaii with his family and missed the vote, and the popular Safe Neighborhoods Act fell 5 votes short of passing. Barack was widely criticized in the press right in the middle of his race for Congress. 3 months later, Bobby Rush won the Democratic primary for the seat by a landslide. The loss was very painful for all of us. In retrospect, Barack recognized the flaws of his campaign, and we learned a lot about what could go wrong, even with talent and commitment. Part of the lesson we took from the loss is that if you're relatively unknown and you go after an incumbent with his own political power base firmly in place, you need to line up big supporters known to the voters to vouch for you. It's just like when you're interviewing someone for a job. If a candidate comes in with a recommendation from someone you know, you're more likely to hire him. When he ran against Bobby Rush, Barack didn't have that. Not long after he lost, Barack came by my office at the Habitat Company one day in search of a sounding board for a few ideas about next steps. We sat around my little conference room table and he said, "I gotta figure out what to do next." Having lost the race, he was now trying to balance his political ambitions with the demands of supporting his new family. We tossed a few ideas around and ultimately he decided to stay where he was, serving in Springfield and supplementing his income with teaching and working in his law firm. But what struck me most about the meeting was what didn't happen. We hardly talked about the loss to Bobby Rush at all. I'd expected him to come into my office dejected and depressed, wanting to commiserate and go over what had gone wrong, but he didn't. He'd already analyzed it, assessed it, and put it behind him, and all that was on his mind was what to do next. The toll our public lives and professions took on our families was a constant topic of conversation between the Jarrett and the Obama families. After Barack joined the Illinois legislature in 1997, Michelle learned firsthand what it meant to raise children married to a man with a very demanding career. They had Malia in 1998 and Sasha in 2001, and while Barack was still a devoted, loving husband and father, as a public servant his hours were long, and he worked from Springfield Monday through Thursday 3 months in the fall and 2 weeks in the spring when the legislature was in session. That, of course, placed a higher burden on Michelle to care for their daughters. In 2002, Michelle was recruited for the position of executive director for community affairs at the University of Chicago Medical Center, a big job with a lot of thorny responsibilities. When the day came for the interview, she didn't have a sitter. Rather than reschedule with Mike Reardon, the president of the medical center, Michelle, not really interested in the job, simply brought Sasha along, and, mercifully, Sasha stayed asleep in her stroller the whole time. Michelle thought that Michael might as well see up front what her life was like. He was both amused and supportive, which piqued Michelle's interest,
and helped Mike win her over.
He offered her the job, and she accepted. She started out not pretending her life was organized in neatly separated packages, and Michael respected her for it. We were both in overdrive during those years, trying to fit all of the pieces of our lives together and make things work. Exercise was a prime example. There was just never time. When Laura was about 10, I started sneaking to the gym in our building around 5:30 a.m., before she woke up. Michelle was always more ambitious. Her schedule made mine look like a luxury cruise. She would wake up at 4 in the morning to go to the gym while her mom babysat. Then she'd be back home and dressed by 7 a.m. to get the girls ready for school. While Michelle was busy being a solo mom part of the time, I was busy being a single mom all of the time. Without Mrs. Brown and my parents, I don't know how I would have made it. They were the glue that held my life together. As a single mom, I felt plenty of guilt when it came to leaving Laura and working long hours. From the time she was 2, I took her to my office to demystify where I was when I wasn't with her. I wanted her always to be able to picture where I was and what I was doing. My parents had done the same with me. I often visited my mom's preschool class when I was young. After she founded the Erickson Institute, a graduate school in child development, I would walk the mile between school and her office and hang out there after school until she was ready to go home. I also went to my dad's office at the university, only 4 blocks from the lab schools. There I pretended to be a doctor, no doubt the origins of my interest in a career in medicine. When I was young, my mom also had a rule that any time I called her at work, no matter the reason, I was to be put through. I can still hear the sound of her high heels clicking, growing louder as she approached the phone. Connecting with my mom whenever I wanted, even if only for a minute, was always reassuring. So I made the same request of all of my assistants. Only once did I come out of a meeting to learn that my daughter had phoned. "How come you didn't put her through?" I asked my assistant. "You were behind closed doors." "My rule means no matter where I am, even if I'm with Mayor Daly, you let me know." Laura said it wasn't important. "You can't expect a 6-year-old to know if it's important," I said. My strictness came partly from my mother's example, but because it was just the 2 of us, I also felt a particular urgency to make sure Laura always knew I was there. All public servants sacrifice, and so do their families. From our men and women in the military to local police, from city council members to the President of the United States, to workers at every level. Disappointing loved ones when a crisis occurs is inevitable. On the first day of the Great Chicago Flood of 1992, I had to cancel a trip to Disney World with my cousin Lynn and her 2 children. The day the city flooded, the entire downtown had to be evacuated. Businesses were forced to close, and no one knew what the short or long-term consequences would be. Mayor Daley sent out an announcement that no staff member was to leave the city until the damage from the flood was contained. Since I was responsible for outreach to all of the affected businesses, my team and I were crucial to all aspects of damage control and recovery. But try explaining to an excited 6-year-old who has been looking forward to the trip why her favorite cousins are going to Disney World, and she is stuck at home. Several days into the crisis, Laura called and said, "Where are you?" At that exact moment, Mayor Daley was about to begin a press conference where I'd be standing beside him. So I quickly said to Laura, "If you want to see me, turn on the television, and I'll look right at you and smile." A year later, I managed to carve out time to take Laura to Euro Disney, by far our favorite day of her childhood. There were countless times when I tried to bolster myself with the knowledge that I was working for the greater good. But it's not easy or simple. As a working single mom, over time, I found that a support system of good friends is crucial. I forged a network of close friends from many circles of my life, and we always came together to assist one another in our careers. That same network was crucial for raising our families as well. Many of my girlfriends who were married with kids faced the same challenges I had. When by the time I left my law firm, I had stopped pretending that I had it all under control.
and had begun to appreciate the importance of being honest about my challenges so we could commiserate. We learned together how to ask for help and not always put ourselves last. Kelly and Michelle used to hang out with a group of young moms who had children around the same age as their four. Since Laura was older than their children, and I had also been Michelle and Kelly's boss, I was more a big sister and sounding board than a hangout buddy. But I always made my home a gathering place where children and adults could come over, relax, and eat a good meal. Susan Schur joined the city as Kelly Welsh's chief deputy in 1989, moving into the office next door to mine. We became each other's sounding boards professionally and personally. Our children were at the lab schools together, and we bonded over the stresses and delights of being single moms. When Barack was away, Michelle was often chopping veggies or stirring something alongside friends in my kitchen while Laura played with the younger children. Since I grew up watching my parents entertain both family and friends as well as work colleagues, I appreciated the value of mealtime in solidifying bonds and helping us all recharge our batteries. Even at 90, my mom continues the tradition of hosting Sunday dinners every week. Dinner doesn't start until 4, but people start coming over at 2 to help cook or just hang out in the kitchen together. I tried to give Michelle, Kelly, and several of our other friends their age the benefit of learning from my experiences. And during those years, we all had a lot of conversations about setting expectations for ourselves and for others. As much as I blamed Bobby for the problems in our marriage, I failed to communicate clearly and openly with him about what my expectations of him were. I was so busy trying to be this perfect, accommodating wife, assuming all of the household chores, and parental ones too, after Laura was born, that I suppressed my own needs. I would try to cajole and convince him to shape up, but I waited for too long to put my foot down and say, "No, this is unacceptable, and if you continue to do it, I'll leave." And by the time I finally did, it was too late anyway. The advice I gave to all my girlfriends, advice I had not followed myself, was to start out the way you want to end up. I started out trying so hard to be perfect, which I defined as accommodating. My mother used to see me doing that, and she'd say to me, "You know, you're not actually that nice. Stop pretending that you are, because Bobby's going to be lulled into thinking you're a pushover, and eventually you're going to get tired of playing house." And she was right. People often start out relationships acting like this ideal version of what they think the other person wants, but it's not sustainable. At some point, you do become yourself, and then what? I also encourage my younger friends to follow Michelle's lead and be upfront with their prospective bosses about what they needed in order to thrive. I openly shared my horror stories of juggling and dropping way too many balls, trying to pretend to my colleagues that my only priority was my work. A little less than 2 years after Barack's loss to Bobby Rush, our lives in Hyde Park had settled into a nice rhythm. I was working at the Habitat Company, and in addition to serving as chair of the CTA, I was the first Black chairman of the University of Chicago Medical Center and vice chairman of the University of Chicago Board of Trustees, and the first African American and the first woman to chair the Chicago Stock Exchange. I had joined a number of other corporate and not-for-profit boards, including the Museum of Science and Industry, where my old boss, David Messina, was the president. I often tell people about my first real summer jobs at 16, as a clinic coordinator at the Med Center and a docent at the museum, jobs that informed my perspective about both institutions decades later as a board member. Michelle was working for Susan Schur, now the general counsel at the University of Chicago Med Center, and Barack, having bounced back from his loss to Bobby Rush, was commuting back and forth between serving as a state senator in Springfield and teaching as a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School. Our lives were full and busy, and the mighty juggle was challenging. Then, Barack started dropping hints he was thinking of running for Illinois' open seat in the U.S. Senate. There were plenty of reasons why he shouldn't do it. Illinois is a microcosm of the United States, with big urban centers and large swaths of rural areas. While predominantly a blue state, it doesn't necessarily vote Democratic. In 1992, when several women were elected to the Senate on the heels of Anita Hill's grilling during Clarence Thomas's Supreme Court nomination hearings, the year of the woman, people called it, a former Cook County official and Illinois state rep, Carol Mosley Braun, had run and won, becoming the first black woman in the Senate and only the second black senator since Reconstruction. But she lost after one term to a white male Republican. When Barack started talking about running, the jury was out on the appetite for a statewide candidate in Illinois who was a person of color. Michelle, for her part, was not pleased that he wanted to run again so soon after his recent loss, and I was surprised myself. I thought it was a bad idea because if he lost the race, his political career would likely be over. Michelle was opposed for some more personal reasons. It would only take him farther away from home, and she already felt she was carrying much more than her fair share of the family responsibilities. So she asked me if I would host a brunch and invite our closest friends over to talk him out of it. Absolutely, I said. So one Sunday morning, a group of us gathered around my dining room table, and I served a spread of bacon and eggs, bread, orange juice, and fruit. I sat at the head of the table. To my immediate left was Michelle, then Barack, John Rogers, Marty Nesbitt, and a few others. As we sat down, I thought we'd staged an effective ambush, and that Barack had no idea he and his ambitions were on the agenda for the morning. But, being the intuitive guy he is, as soon as we were gathered around the table, he seemed to sense that we'd all been given marching orders by Michelle, so he preemptively broached the subject. "There's something I want to talk to you all about," he said, and then launched into all of the reasons why he wanted to run for the Senate. He explained why this race would be different from his first run for Congress. This time there was an open seat, and he had the backing of the powerful Illinois Senate President Emil Jones. And he had a better sense of the ground organization needed to run a successful campaign. Having matured as both a candidate and a legislator, he was also the only state senator from Chicago who frequently traveled to downstate Illinois, so people there knew him and he knew what they cared about. True to his curious nature, he was interested in learning about farming and agriculture. "I vote on issues that affect the entire state," he reasoned, "so I need to understand the state." I spoke up first. "I think it's a terrible idea," I said. I thought it was a long shot that the people on farms in southern Illinois would rally behind anyone from Chicago. And I added, "If you have back-to-back losses, that's it for you in politics." "But I'm not afraid of that," he said. "I'm okay with knowing that if I lose this race, I'll have to find a new career. And if I'm okay with that, why aren't you?" I didn't have an answer, but the way he posed the question made me think about courage. Courage isn't the absence of fear. Courage is overcoming fear. It's willingness to risk failure, believing in your own resilience to survive if you come up short. I think Barack's courage was partly temperament, but also from growing up the way he had. Even though he was a black man, the three people who loved him the most before he met Michelle were all white, his mom and his grandparents, and they believed he could actually do whatever he wanted. The cautionary reality checks I'd heard constantly from my mother growing up just weren't a part of his childhood. Faced with Barack's well-thought-out analysis and ability to persuade, I was running out of objections to his running, but I'd pledged to Michelle that I'd do whatever I could to talk him out of it. So I threw out the biggest remaining obstacle. "But what about money?" I asked. "Senate campaigns are insanely expensive. Where on earth are you going to get that kind of money?" With a knowing twinkle in his eye, he said, "You're going to chair my finance committee." By the end of the three-hour brunch, everyone was on board, even Michelle. But she had one caveat, which she held in reserve until the very end of the conversation. "Okay," she said, "we'll do this, but if you lose, can we say this is over and you'll get a real job?" "Yes," he committed. Barack's Senate campaign added a completely new dimension to our relationship. I'd volunteered on his earlier campaigns and had always supported him, but this was my first time taking on a central role, and we had a big uphill climb ahead. That year's Democratic primary campaign was a grind. Barack was up against six other candidates in what the New York Times called an expensive and messy race. One of his opponents was a multimillionaire who poured his own money into the campaign right from the beginning, with glitzy commercials saturating TV and radio stations. Another was a well-known statewide official whom everyone expected would have the party establishment behind him. There were so many players already in the field that it was hard for Barack to find a campaign manager or any other seasoned political operatives with track records of successful statewide campaigns. The most experienced person willing to take him on was the political strategist David Axelrod, well known to many in Chicago as a Tribune reporter and as a key strategist for Mayor Daley's campaigns. I had one primary qualification to be the chair of Barack's finance committee, my relationships with some of Chicago's wealthiest business leaders. But beyond that, I didn't have any experience fundraising in a statewide campaign, and it was slow going at first. Even among my closest friends, I had trouble drumming up support for such a long-shot candidate. One evening, having convinced the chairman of the University of Chicago, Jim Crown, and the university president, Don Randall, to host a fundraiser, a dicey ask given that there were a number of Republicans on the board, I walked into the event early and saw that only 6 people had shown up, including me. My heart sank. But when Barack showed up, he appeared unfazed. While I drank 2 glasses of wine to calm my nerves at the poor showing, he gave the handful of guests his best campaign pitch. Sitting on a coffee table with the small group gathered around, he was the same man who liked going to country fairs and spending time in southern Illinois, just talking and listening. Authentically caring is the most important political skill. People can tell when you're genuinely interested in their lives. Luckily, the campaign improved. With lots of practice and plenty of pressure from the candidate, I got better at asking for money. And as Barack's profile grew, my cell phone started to ring constantly as I was rushing between meetings, juggling the ridiculous number of obligations I'd taken on to fill my life after Laura departed for college. I said yes to too many board invitations because I was flattered, but realized I was spread too thin, and I began stepping down unless I cared passionately about the mission and could make a unique contribution. As the campaign finances improved, one source of tension did develop between the candidate and me: punctuality. I am never late. My father and mother are both punctual, but my dad carried it to an extreme. Punctuality to him meant being early. Bring a book, he always said. The broader lesson he tried to teach me is that it's rude to keep anybody waiting. Their time is as important as yours, and showing up early is a sign of respect. Barack, on the other hand, was habitually late in both his social life and his political life. For the host of a political gathering, the 2 biggest fears are people going to show up and will the candidate show up? I thought Barack should arrive early to put the host at ease. Barack thought he should arrive later to be efficient with his time. Whenever I suggested we organize his schedule so he could get places early, he responded, "I'll get there as soon as I can." His tardiness to fundraisers was irksome, but not enough to do battle with him. But the time he was late to a televised debate, that was nerve-wracking. It was the first televised debate among all 7 Democratic primary candidates. Michelle and I had arrived at WTTW, the local public television station sponsoring the debate, 45 minutes early. Michelle is as punctual as I am. Barack had a vote that day in Springfield. Traveling from there brings you into Chicago on the southeast side. The TV studios, meanwhile, were far northwest of the city, and it was pouring rain. 30 minutes before the start time, Michelle and I inquired of a campaign aide about Barack's ETA. All the aide could tell us was that he was on the way. 20 minutes out, Michelle said, "Call the campaign manager." I stepped to the side and called him on my cell phone. "I'm sitting with Mrs. Obama, waiting for the debate to begin," I said, "and she'd like to know where her husband is." "Barack is on his way," he said. "That's what I told her 10 minutes ago. I can't go back with that." He put me on hold for what was probably 30 seconds, but felt like an hour. I looked over at Michelle sitting with her arms folded. The campaign manager came back. "The senator just passed Soldier Field," he said. That meant he was at least 30 minutes away. Knowing Michelle, I couldn't give her "he's on his way" again. Plus, I wanted to have company in my own panicked state. I told her the truth. Then I watched as she calculated the distance in her head and came up with the same answer I had. It would be impossible for him to get there on time. 5 minutes out from the start, Michelle turned to me again and said in a firm, low voice, "I want to know exactly where he is." I went into the hall and called the campaign manager again. He said Barack was approaching the building, which of course could mean anything. I needed to show her movement, so I relayed the message. The studio audience was packed with supporters of all the candidates, chatting with anticipation, while the two of us sat alone, staring straight ahead in our silent panic. 2 minutes out, one of the producers approached us. "Mrs. Obama," she said, "it seems like your husband is not going to make it on time. Would you like to go on for him at the top?" She looked at me, then turned to the producer with an unmistakable expression that said, "No." 1 minute out, the music started, and the moderator, Phil Ponce, read from the teleprompter, "Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We're joined tonight by the 7 candidates for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate representing Illinois." The camera slowly panned across the stage. 6 candidates, all seated in a row, and 1 empty chair. "We'll be back in 60 seconds. In those 60 seconds, Barack Obama strode in, said hello to his opponents, sat in a chair, picked up his microphone and attached it to his lapel, calm, cool, and collected the whole time. When the cameras came back, Barack looked out at the room with his 1,000-megawatt smile. I could have killed him. If you were to ask Michelle or me what was the worst moment of the campaign, that would have been it. But the candidate himself was oblivious. He missed the mounting stress as the minutes counted down. He wasn't in the room to watch his empty chair as the credits began to roll. When we fussed at him later, he shrugged and said if he had been late, he would have explained that he had a good excuse. He was doing his job in Springfield for his constituents. And that was the difference between us. He simply doesn't sweat. We do. Michelle is the worrier. She believes if you're not prepared, catastrophe lurks, which is why she's always well-organized and well-prepared and punctual. Barack, on the other hand, assumes it will all work out fine, so he feels perfectly comfortable winging it. For the 2008 Democratic National Convention, her speech was done and practiced to perfection a week ahead of time, while he was still editing his on the way to the convention center. They would both say they're pragmatic. Michelle, because she prepares for the worst by systematically analyzing the pros and cons of every decision. Barack, because the worst just doesn't scare him. With a deep reservoir of resilience, he believes he can always bounce back. I'm somewhere in between. In general, I'm not as well organized as she is, but I'm also too afraid to wing it, to assume all will go well, as he does. That was a familiar place for me. I was somewhere between my parents, who had a similar dynamic. Stressful as the campaign was, Barack kept his calm, cool demeanor the whole time. I saw it break down only once. We were near the end of the Senate primary. He was down in the polls, and he was late to meetings, speeches, and fundraisers, and he wasn't making phone calls to raise money. At some events, he appeared lethargic, and worse, indifferent. His once passionate stump speech was lackluster. The entire campaign staff felt it. The audience felt it. I felt it. Even the donors I was calling started to ask, "Does he really want to win?" I invited him to lunch at the East Penn Club to talk about the problem. "I must be in trouble if you've invited me to lunch," he said slightly sheepishly when he arrived. I explained to him what I and the other staffers had been seeing. "You seem ambivalent," I said. He paused, perhaps toying with the idea of bluffing his way through our talk, but then he simply admitted it. "I am," he said. "What's going on? We don't have to do this, you know." He sat for a moment, and then tears welled up in his eyes. "If I win," he said, "it's going to pull me even further away from my family. The magnitude of that is finally sinking in." Seeing his emotion, the big sister in me came out. I always knew how much Michelle missed him when he was in Springfield or off campaigning, but this was the first time I fully appreciated the impact on him. I never saw it as my role with Barack to be the one to pressure him to make one decision or another. Instead, I gave him a safe place to express his feelings, being a sounding board to help him reach his own decisions. And that's what I tried to do at lunch that day. I looked at him and I said quietly, "You are one of the few politicians I know who truly puts your family first. If you don't want to do it, let's not do it. But you need to figure it out." "I know," he said, "I know." We parted with a hug after lunch, and I didn't bring up the subject again. Without any explicit declaration from him, I started to see his energy and passion returning to his campaign. I assumed he came to some sort of inner reconciliation, that it was the right decision to move forward. It gradually built up, and within a couple of weeks he hit his stride again. When he came back to life, he was all in. Barack was still the underdog in the primary, but that quickly turned around when the lead candidate, Blair Hull, a former securities trader who'd put $29 million of his own money into his campaign, crashed and burned after it was revealed that one of his ex-wives had taken out an order of protection against him because she feared for her safety during their marriage. Coincidentally, Hull's campaign imploded right around the time we finally had enough money to go on TV with commercials and really push our message, and we surged in the polls. Twice as hard, twice as good, and three times as lucky. And Barack's luck didn't end there. That summer, John Kerry tapped him to give the keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention, giving a then relatively unknown candidate a chance to make a name for himself on a global stage. In the general election that fall, the campaign of Barack's Republican opponent, Jack Ryan, also imploded when it came out that he had pressured his then-wife to go to sex clubs. Ryan denied his ex-wife's allegations, but it was too late. He was forced out of the race, and the conservative firebrand chosen to replace him, Alan Keyes, though annoying in how low he was willing to stoop to win, never stood a chance. Barack won a whopping 70% of the votes. With his win, Barack became a national figure and a rising star in the Democratic Party. But there would be a personal cost he knew all too well, his family. For a time, Barack tried to make the case that Michelle and the girls should move with him to D.C., but I was relieved when they decided the family should remain in Chicago. To take them away from their community, asking Michelle to raise two small children in a town where she didn't know anyone, without the support of her network, was not the right thing to do. Not yet, anyway. Chapter 8. The Power of Each Voice. By the time John Kerry picked Senate candidate Barack Obama to give the keynote address at the 2004 Democratic Convention in July, he had already been tagged as an up-and-coming political superstar. Then he gave the speech. I was quite nervous before it began, sitting with Laura in the Obama Friends and Family box in Boston's Fleet Center, waiting for him to come on stage. I couldn't breathe. I thought of all the ways it could turn into a disaster. What if his mind went blank? What if the crowd was flat? What if he said, too much? Laura had watched him on TV a few days earlier, and she had mentioned the ums, a comment I passed along to him. I cared so much about the outcome, yet simply had no control. I needn't have worried. About 3 minutes into the speech to the packed stadium, I went from anxious to mesmerized. I was inspired. I felt such pride in how he delivered so passionate a message of unity. We are not a red America or a blue America. We are the United States of America. When he finished, the convention center erupted in jubilance. He had captured the essence of the American dream for a more perfect union. Everyone in our box was crying and hugging one another when he finished. Our emotion was rippling across the stadium, our country, and the world. That was the first time I fully appreciated his extraordinary ability to connect, to make each of us feel he was speaking directly to us, to see ourselves in his story. At his party afterwards, I stood by the door so I could congratulate Barack as soon as he walked in. Once I caught his eye, he came over to where I was standing with Laura, leaned over, and without saying a word, gave me a kiss on the cheek. Then he turned to Laura and asked, "I didn't say too much, did I?" She replied, laughing, that no, he had not. 2 weeks later, Laura and I escaped on our annual trip to Martha's Vineyard. I rented a home with a beautiful view of the ocean in Eastchop. The Obamas needed a break from the grueling campaign, and so they joined us for a few days. On our first morning there, Barack went for a run alone along the ocean path by our house. When he returned, he announced to Michelle and me, with great surprise, "You'll never guess what happened. Somebody recognized me and took my photo." Michelle and I both laughed, and she said, "It must have been a pretty good speech." A quip Barack and Michelle started using after the speech when people reacted to him so differently than before it. But I also sensed it was a sign that our lives were beginning to change. 2 years later, after Senator Obama had become even more of a national figure, the buzz and energy he'd unleashed had only grown. For the 2006 midterms, he was the hottest ticket in the Democratic Party at every candidate's campaign event. The reception of his second book, The Audacity of Hope, was nothing short of astounding. My parents had hosted a party at their home for his first book, Dreams for My Father. Only about 40 people came, and they'd come only because I twisted their arms. 11 years later, in October of 2006, my parents threw a second book party for Barack. It was pouring rain that night, so I'd asked a young friend to ferry guests into the backyard tent under his umbrella. He could not possibly keep up with the tide, and everyone was drenched, but buoyant. Feeling the energy in the tent as Barack addressed the crowd, and tearing up when he spoke about his love for Michelle and her sacrifices, I thought to myself, he's going to run. Barack and I had spoken periodically about his running for president, starting with his Senate victory in 2004. They were always very casual conversations, loose in detail and timing, but I could tell that he was restless in the Senate. The behind-the-scenes antics that kept the Senate from making real progress frustrated him. As he used to say when comparing the Illinois legislature and the U.S. Senate, more decimal points, same problems. But after just 2 years in the Senate, I wasn't convinced the timing was right, especially with Hillary Clinton's formidable presence looming. Then, right after Christmas of 2006, Laura and I were in Anguilla with a few friends and family. One evening, as we sat around chatting before dinner, my phone rang. It was Barack, who, as usual, was in Hawaii with his family for the holidays. I stepped outside into the warm evening air to have a private conversation. "I'm leaning towards doing this," he said. I knew exactly what this was. He said he knew it would be a long shot. Hillary Clinton had been senator longer than he, and she not only was a former first lady, but also had been a major policy advisor to President Clinton. Over the years, she and her husband, who had name recognition, to put it mildly, generated enormous support and loyalty within the Democratic Party and its donors. But what Barack had was a vision for an inclusive America, and he was unburdened by political baggage. He was the new darling of the party and clearly on fire. Perhaps that's why, even though the odds were very much against Barack, when he said he was leaning towards this, my only reply was, "Great, when do we start?" The wild card was, of course, Michelle. She wasn't nearly as quick to climb on board as I was, and if she said no, all bets were off. Once we were back from vacation, she called me up to talk it over, the first of several conversations. She was understandably concerned about what the campaign could mean for their family, including the possibility that it might actually put their lives in danger. She also questioned whether this was the right time for any of them, knowing how hard it had been for her so far to shoulder most of the responsibilities for raising their daughters. Michelle was hesitant to stand in the way of his dream, knowing he had a special gift and a true drive to serve. She also wanted us all to face the harsh realities of what this decision would mean to him and their family. "I'm already hanging on by my fingertips, and now he wants to do this," she said. "How's it going to work?" "It's going to be really hard," I said, "but we'll figure it out." But no surprise here, that wasn't good enough for Michelle. She wanted an accurate gauge of how hard this was going to be, with no sugarcoating, so she would be prepared. In January of the new year, Barack called together a small group of advisors in David Axelrod's office for a meeting with him and Michelle to play out the scenario of a presidential run. Joining us were Steve Hillebrand, considered the political guru of Iowa, David Plouffe, an associate of Axelrod's, with lots of presidential campaign experience, Alyssa Mastromonaco, who had managed scheduling for Senator John Kerry's presidential campaign and now did the same in Barack's Senate office, Robert Gibbs, also a Kerry veteran and Barack's communications director, and Pete Rouse, chief of staff of Barack's Senate office in Washington, who, with